Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. Over the past few days, we've had wide-ranging conversations with Vietnamese-American writers and artists about the importance of moving the voices and stories of the Vietnamese diaspora from the margins to the center. Today, we are talking about what we have and have not learned from the Vietnam War with Professor Christian Oppie, who's best known for his books on the war. American Reckoning, the Vietnam War, and Our National Identity is a history of the war's impact on American national identity, culture, and foreign policy from the 1950s through the Obama administration. Patriots, the Vietnam War Remembered from All Sides, is a wide-ranging oral history from multiple perspectives, including accounts of Vietnamese and American combatants, policymakers, anti-war activists, and journalists. Working Class War, American Combat Soldiers in Vietnam, is a social history of American combat soldiers. Christian Oppie is professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's teaching a course called Imperial America, United States and the World from the late 19th century to the present. He also teaches a course on the war in Vietnam. Professor Oppie is also director of the Ellsberg Initiative for Peace and Democracy. In 2019, Daniel Ellsberg chose to make the University of Massachusetts Amherst the home for his papers. The Ellsberg collection consists of 500 boxes of materials that document the rise of the national security state, nuclear policy and war planning, the Pentagon Papers, Watergate, the impact of individual whistleblowing and collective dissent, and much more. Daniel Ellsberg passed away on June 16, 2023, after a battle with pancreatic cancer. He was 92. Professor Christian Oppie is writing a biography of Daniel Ellsberg with the working title Ellsberg's Mutiny, War and Resistance in the Age of Vietnam, the Pentagon Papers, and Nuclear Terror. Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. What do you make of media coverage overall of this 50-year anniversary? What stands out for you?
Well, that's a very good question. I actually have been impressed by how little coverage it's received in this country. I mean, in Vietnam, of course, there've been. I understand that the people have been in the streets for days anticipating the anniversary. So I don't think there's been that much coverage. And what I've seen has been, I have to say, pretty superficial. There's been very little effort to go back and try to assess what we did in and to Vietnam 50 and 70 years ago. This is really in keeping, actually, I think, with the way since the 1980s, we have tried to convert our thinking about the war from serious scrutiny of history to a kind of therapy or a kind of healing from the war. So we're still trying to make ourselves feel better for that moment.
What would you like to see in the media?
Well, I still think that as a country, and this includes the media, we need to have a full reckoning with what was, in my view, a clear war of aggression in Vietnam that left more than 3 million Vietnamese dead and did great damage to their country for many decades. There's still the effects of Agent Orange and unexploded ordnance that are hurting and wounding and even still killing people in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos. So there is still that to be done. And there is, you know, some evidence that some Americans are doing that. It's still a subject that gets a lot of academic attention, and students still flock to courses on it. It's amazing. My course on the war still attracts 120 students every year. So I'm not completely negative about the ways that we're struggling still with this history. But the media still largely paints it as a kind of well-intentioned American tragedy. This is sort of the theme of the Ken Burns, Lynn Novick documentary that's now, boy, it's been 7 or 8 years since that came out, but that 10-part series on the Vietnam War, really focused, I think, more attention on sort of the psychological wounds of the war in America than really scrutinizing the war's impact in Vietnam.
This war greatly shaped your life. How did you become a Vietnam War scholar?
Well, I don't have a dramatic story. I came of age just in the wake of the Vietnam generation turning 18 in 1973, the year the draft ended and the final American troops were removed. I didn't even know a single person that was fighting in Vietnam or older people deeply engaged in the anti-war movement. But it tells you something about that history, that a person like me who's living in a, you know, relatively privileged suburb could be so moved as I was and troubled by the war as a teenager that I felt by the time I got to college, even in high school, a kind of moral obligation to begin learning more about it. I mean, I had a kind of gut or visceral feeling that this was a horrible war, but I didn't know much about it and sort of made it my business to try to find out. And the deeper I went into it, the more I kept returning to it. I mean, I wrote the books you cited. The first one, Working Class War, I thought I'd go off and do something else, but I came back to the topic and did another book. And then again, a third time, and now with Ellsberg, kind of a fourth return to the subject. So I just think it's a crucial moment in American history, among other things. And part of what that impressed me, and I write about this in American Reckoning, is that during the war years, there really was the kind of broad scrutiny of and questioning of America's role in the world. It kind of reached a peak as the war was still going on. I mean, there are polls from the early 70s that indicate that more than 70% of the American people thought the war was a mistake. But more significantly, one poll in 71, fall of 71, showed that 65% of Americans believed the American war in Vietnam was wrong and immoral. That kind of level of self-criticism really goes away in the decades after the war, and never to be returned. And one of the things that gets questioned during the war is this idea of American exceptionalism, that we are the greatest force for good in the world and always on the side of democracy and human rights. The war and other parts of the 60s, the civil rights movement and other social ferment, I think did more than at any other moment in our history. It really shattered that broad faith in American superiority. But in the decades since, there's been this quite successful effort to cobble it back together again. It's a more defensive and brittle form of American exceptionalism, and I would say more inward looking, whereas in the 50s and early 60s, Americans really had this view that our values could be exported and universal. Now I think there's a more kind of xenophobic mindset in America that feels that the rest of the world often doesn't see our virtues.
This is so important to focus on. In the Boston Review piece you wrote in 2018, you write, never before had such a wide range of citizens cutting across lines of class, race, gender, and religion rejected the claim that the United States was a unique and invincible force for good. Before we talk about how conservatives at the time responded to all of this, can you also remind us, as you point out, you actually start by writing about Martin Luther King Jr.'s, what you call the greatest speech of his life, a piercing critique of the war in Vietnam. 2,000 people jammed into New York's Riverside Church on April 4th, 1967, to hear King shred the historical, political, and moral claims that U.S. leaders had invoked since the end of World War II to justify their counter-revolutionary foreign policy. Can you just remind us of that speech and why you think it was so powerful?
Well, it's powerful in many ways, largely because while he does focus great attention on the particularities of that war, he makes clear that this is not just a struggle to end one war, that unless we really have a fundamental change in our values, there are going to be more Vietnams. And so we really have to overcome, he said, the tribalism of nation, race, class, region, and develop more universal commitments to humanity. And he talked about the threats, the triple threats of racism, militarism, and materialism that the war had exposed. And he also calls it the Vietnam War, a war on the poor. And he meant that in at least three different ways. One is that the people we were fighting in Vietnam were poor, by and large. That the people we were supporting, the government in Saigon that never developed the broad support of its own people, were elites, South Vietnamese elites, by and large. It was also a war on the poor in the sense that the American draft system made it far easier for young men of a certain privilege and connection to evade military service. So the war was essentially fought by working class and poor people. And then finally, it was a war on the poor because the resources expended to wage it were diminishing the resources that might have been spent to continue and enlarge the very ambitious programs of the Great Society under President Johnson in the mid-60s. So it really is a devastating critique in many ways.
You also point out, and I wonder why we don't hear about this more. I didn't even know about this, Project 100,000. The military draft offered deferments and exemptions that favored the privileged, while programs such as Project 100,000 enlisted men from the, quote, subterranean poor, men so badly educated they would once have been rejected for military service. Project 100,000 was touted as a program of social uplift, but in reality, it sent poor men to the front lines as cannon fodder. Why don't we hear more about this Project 100,000?
It's a good question. I think it's because, you know, when the draft ended, we sort of stopped thinking about how it worked and how skewed it was, you know, by class and also, but to a lesser degree, by race. And indeed, one might say that the absence of a draft to the present, not that I'm not an advocate of returning to the draft, but I don't think that we can really deny the fact that in the absence of a draft and having an all-volunteer force does allow the vast, vast majority of the American people to be oblivious to the fact that we've been, you know, at war for most of the 21st century. Mm. And, you know, have relied on well under 1% of our population to wage these wars and requiring them to go on multiple tours of duty into these war zones. And while we've lost fewer than we did in Vietnam, 58,000 Americans died in Vietnam and more than 7,000 plus have died in the wars of this century. But it should be noted that the burdens that the troops today have faced have led to more than 30,000 suicides. Mm. So far more than those who have died in combat have come back so traumatized with war-related traumas that they've taken their own lives.
Gosh, you know, I was just curious. We've done shows about this in the past, but we haven't in a long time. And I just searched. I mean, this is just an unbelievable number. According to Everytown Research and Policy, an average of 18 veterans die by suicide in the United States every day, 13 of them by firearm. Right. I mean, how is this just not talked about more? 18
yes,
a day?
I know, and I don't have a good answer for that, except to say that I think we have convinced ourselves that we are taking care of our soldiers and veterans by thanking them for their service, these sort of empty gestures that we all feel so obliged to participate in, which I do believe is a direct legacy of a post-Vietnam false memory, actually, that was used to demonize this vibrant, diverse anti-war movement and to turn it into a kind of caricature of sort of sanctimonious, self-involved, campus-based, long-haired hippies, draft dodgers, unpatriotic kids who like nothing better than to yell at returning veterans and call them baby killers and even spit upon them. This was a very pervasive characterization of the anti-war movement in the 1980s and continues, though not as powerfully, to the present day. I've had students over the years that grew up believing that the most shameful thing about the American war in Vietnam was not the vast wreckage that we visited on Vietnam, nor even the fact that we were defeated, but the most shameful thing was the treatment of American veterans returning home, especially at the hands of the anti-war movement. Now, there are certainly things that the veterans we could have done better by the veterans, the government could have, and corporations, but it's simply not right to argue that the anti-war movement was sort of routinely swearing at and spitting upon returning veterans. In fact, one of the more remarkable things about that period is the degree to which active duty military and returning veterans got engaged in the anti-war movement. Right. And in the latter years of the war, they were the most vibrant part of it and the most significant part. Vietnam Veterans Against the War staged some extraordinary demonstrations, including one in 1971, where hundreds of veterans lined up in front of the Capitol and threw the medals that they had earned in Vietnam onto the steps of the Capitol. They could no longer bear to possess awards and honors that they had gotten in a war that they had concluded was immoral.
You know, the other thing, Chris, just doing these shows over the last couple days, so many of us are connected to this war. I don't know why I've never thought about it like this, but my dad's brother served in Vietnam. And when he returned, he was never the same. He drank a lot. He spent a lot of time in his room. He sadly died at a young age. And I have no idea. No one in our family knows what he experienced because no one ever talked about it. And then my dad almost went, but his arm wouldn't lay straight when he put it out on a table. So he wasn't accepted. And he was told that if he had surgery, he could go, but he declined. And sadly, several of his friends who served were killed. And then my cousin, Dugan Aguilar, served with the Marines as a forward observer. He suffered, like so many, from disabilities caused by exposure to Agent Orange. He also had PTSD. And I just want to mention that he went on to become a very well-known Native American photographer. And if you're in the Bay Area, his photos are now on display at the Oakland Museum. Unfortunately, he died in 2018 at, I think, is a young age, 71, and his family thinks it was connected to Agent Orange. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that your personal story reminds me of is that, you know, I've met a lot of veterans over the years, and you can't generalize too much. They're different, and they have different political views, but one very common thing they share is a deep sense that they were betrayed, really, by this older generation of policymakers that sent them under sort of false pretext to this war, you know, told that they were going to protect people and to protect a burgeoning democracy and fight off the communist aggression that was threatening their lives. And then they arrived in Vietnam, and almost immediately they realized that they were not being greeted as liberators or even allies, but with great suspicion, if not open hostility. And they realized quickly that they weren't protecting anybody or saving anybody. They were damaging the very country they were supposedly sent to be saving. nor was it clear that they were defending some kind of great burgeoning democracy, but a kind of police state. So, you know, the contradictions between how the war was justified and explained and how it was waged in the realities on the ground, that created, you know, as you'd expect, great bitterness and a sense of betrayal that veterans carry back with them to the states. And I think is at the heart of why so many of them had war-related psychological problems.
Today, we're speaking with Chris Oppie, professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He is the author of three books about the war in Vietnam: American Reckoning, the Vietnam War and Our National Identity, Patriots, the Vietnam War Remembered from All Sides, and Working Class War, American Combat Soldiers and Vietnam. He's also writing a biography of Daniel Ellsberg with the working title Ellsberg's Mutiny. If you have any questions or comments, what do you think we have and have not learned from the Vietnam War and really U.S. exceptionalism overall? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from Bill, whose father served in Vietnam, and he says, what have we not yet learned based on the lessons from this war?
That's a very good question. I think a lot of Americans learned that we should have a more restrained and democratic and transparent foreign policy, that we shouldn't vest so much extraordinary imperial power in the office of the president. But I think American public opinion has, since the Vietnam War, clearly been more desirous of peace than our policymakers. The problem is, one president after another didn't learn that lesson, particularly after 9/11. Whatever sort of restraint had checked American foreign policy in the 25 years after Vietnam, and it is true, in those 25 years, fewer than 1,000 Americans were killed in combat. Whatever restraints there were went out the window with 9/11. And the lessons that policymakers learned were the wrong lessons from Vietnam, which perhaps they did to a certain extent realize that the American public was not going to tolerate protracted war with high American casualties like Vietnam. But we ended up in this century getting in wars that were even more protracted, long lasting than Vietnam, but with smaller casualties and a greater reliance on technology and firepower. And it should be said too that one of the lessons policymakers learned is not to give so much access to the media covering these wars. So you had things like embedding journalists or relying on pools of journalists to get access to the fighting. More importantly than that, even the military became in this century incredibly sophisticated at producing its own news and packaging it for the major media. So unfortunately we have not had leadership that has learned what I at least would think would be the most important lessons of the Vietnam War, that foreign policy must be more democratic, that Congress has to uphold its constitutional responsibility to have a role in the formulation of foreign policy, and particularly to have the guts to declare war if and when it should take place, as opposed to passing these resolutions, which we've done really since Korea forward, that just defer to the president the authority to make war when and where he or she chooses.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we are speaking with Professor Chris Oppie. He's professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's the author of three books on the Vietnam War, and he's writing a biography of Daniel Ellsberg. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Murray Carpenter will discuss his new book, Sweet and Deadly: How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. We'll also discuss the May Day protests planned for tomorrow against the right-wing attacks on public services. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, You can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War, what we have and have not learned, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You know, thinking about what you said before the break, Chris, about what we have not learned, it's not just the United States. A new report that came out from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, they've tracked weapons and conflict for six decades. Their 2024 spending report finds that for the second year in a row, military expenditure increased in all five of the world's geographical regions, reflecting heightened geopolitical tensions across the globe. And of course, the United States always leads. They've got $997 billion in military spending. The report points out that the United States not only allocated 3.2 times more than the second largest spender, which is China, but also accounted for 37% of global military spending and 66% of spending by NATO. And then you've got the Trump administration pursuing a $1 trillion budget for the next fiscal year. So here they are cutting Head Start, Meals on Wheels, you know, programs that are helping the most vulnerable in this country, and they want to boost Pentagon spending by another $150 billion.
Yes, we spend more on the military than the nine other most militarized countries in the world combined. And unlike other countries, we continue to hold 750 military bases on foreign soil. I think the next largest number, some countries have maybe a dozen on foreign soil. So yes, we have not drawn down in the way that some people thought we might after the end of the Cold War in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Remember all that talk about a possible peace dividend coming out of that period. But you're right, we have sort of doubled down in seeking, as the military refers to it, full spectrum dominance. That's the phrase they often use, meaning we should be able to dominate every space, the land, the oceans, the sky, outer space, cyberspace, everything.
And this also happens under Democrats. It just keeps going up.
Yeah, absolutely.
In January, the Biden administration, right before he left office, told Congress that he planned another $8 billion in weapon sales to Israel. And so that's another reason why U.S. military spending went up.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think it is? I mean, we've done a lot of shows about weapons companies and how their stock continues to go up. We've done shows. 60 Minutes actually had an incredible report. This is very rare for a mainstream media outlet, but they had a great report last year about how everything from the screw to the, you know, name the tool or the what's used for various weapons like the F-35, how if you bought the same thing online, but then if the military or the Pentagon buys it, it the price goes up by 10 to 20 times. I mean, it was a really great report, but nothing came of it. Why do you think this is happening? I mean, what do you think it is? It's a U.S. exceptionalism is also important.
Yeah, it's very troubling. I mean, one thing it shows is the enormous power of these, weapons manufacturers and all the technological companies related to it. Another fact is that in every congressional district in the country has military contracts. So even people who regard themselves as progressive Democrats in the House, few of them are as willing as they should be to stand up against this military-industrial congressional think tank complex that it just sustains itself and grows. You put it perfectly. I mean, it's not drawing down; it's just getting bigger.
Hmm. Yeah, well, if anyone's interested in the 60 Minutes investigation, it found weapons contractors like Lockheed and Raytheon overcharged the Pentagon on almost everything the Department of Defense buys with taxpayer dollars every year. Half of the largest military budget goes to weapons contractors. It's just, I wish we had more reporting on that, because I think the average person would be outraged by this, but it's just, it rarely gets attention. We have a couple of callers, and I know you have to leave us at 45 after. So let's hear from our callers and then we'll get you to respond. Let's go to David in Redwood City. Hi, David. Thanks for holding.
Hi. 50 years ago today, I was off the coast of Vietnam in an aircraft carrier. So this topic just causes me to reflect. And I actually, I have on the front seat next to me, I have the yearbook, the cruise yearbook from that Westpac cruise. I was going to show it to my coworkers at lunch today because a lot of them are younger. And I'm just, I felt pretty strongly when we left Afghanistan in rather hurried fashion. And I'm just, I don't think we'll ever learn, but I hope we do. And I see this isolationist regime that we seem to be in right now could easily lead us to another war. Is isolationism tend to lead to lead to wars starting?
Well, thank you so much, David. Do you want to share any other thoughts, how you're reflecting, given that you're so close, you were so close to all of this?
20 years old, and I was pretty clueless politically. Four of the last 5 weekends, I've been out protesting the regime, so I'm much more aware now. I don't know what else I really have to say other than it's just time to reflect, and I wish we would learn. Did I say that about the Peter, Paul, and Mary song, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? And it says, when will we ever learn? And it doesn't seem like it. So.
Wow. Well, thank you for calling in, David. What are your thoughts on David's question? Does isolationism lead to war?
Well, I don't really think we've turned to isolationism. A more sort of, I would call it unilateralism. I mean, Trump does not really want to bring our military home, so to speak. I mean, we're still deeply involved around the globe. He has no consistent policy on anything. So that's the thing that makes it so volatile and worrisome, that you know, one day he talks about he's going to bring peace to us immediately, and the next day you feel like he's going to launch a war. I don't really have a good answer for that. I do think we have to be involved in the world. I just think we have to be involved in ways that rely on diplomacy rather than military intervention.
Well, thanks again for calling in, David. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. I hope you can hear me. Just maybe a comment to your guest and ask for a response. I remember when I was in the anti-war movement back in the late 60s that Johnson had used the attack on the naval ships, American ships in the Gulf of Tonkin, as a justification to increase our involvement in Vietnam. And in the Burns documentary, which I've watched little snippets of, but it's too horrible to watch, I think, he just makes that that statement that that's what's happened. You know, our destroyers were attacked by North Vietnamese naval ships. You know, and for the longest time, I remember people on the left doubted that those attacks. They thought that was not an accurate justification. But it was several years ago after I thought about this, and I thought, okay, even if those attacks happened, what were American naval ships doing in the Gulf of Tonkin, 10,000 miles away from the American mainland? That question didn't get asked by people on the left a lot. we just assume that that was a false flag or whatever you want to call it. But even if it happened, what were they doing there?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. They were. It's clear that they were engaged in a secret war against North Vietnam. They were collecting intelligence while small South Vietnamese patrol boats were attacking coastal installations and villages in North Vietnam. That little-known but secret war had been going on since 1961, the so-called Gulf of Tonkin incident, where a couple of Vietnamese patrol boats chase after an American destroyer. That happened in 64. So Johnson told several lies about that incident. He said it was an unprovoked attack on innocent American ships on the high seas, and that it was based, there was unequivocal evidence that there had been two attacks. Well, in fact, there had been only one. The second one didn't happen. But the more important lie was that it was unprovoked. We had provoked that attack and used it as a justification to get Congress to pass a resolution that gave LBJ a blank check to escalate the war, which he promised not to do, by the way, in that same year when he was running for president. And in effect, the American public voted for a peace candidate, and only after electing him in a landslide did he vastly escalate the war the following year.
Well, thanks for calling, Greg. Chris, I know we have to let you go in just a few minutes. We're going to play a clip of Daniel Ellsberg when we say goodbye. You're working on a biography of Ellsberg. What are your thoughts about how we should be thinking about Daniel Ellsberg on this anniversary?
Well, I would say the first thing is he would say, if he were still with us, that he did not operate in a vacuum. He would always say, courage is contagious, and he would not have taken the risk he did, which was to face a 115-year prison sentence for turning over the 7,000 pages of classified documents called the dubbed the Pentagon Papers, that revealed two decades of government lies about the causes and conduct of the Vietnam War. He would not have done that had he not been inspired by the bravery of younger Americans who were going to prison to resist the draft. More than 3,000 did 2 years of prison at least for resisting the draft. So I think that's one important thing to note. But I would also note that he was, I don't know of another person, official, government official, with his access to power and to privileged information, who took such a personal risk to try to overturn the very policies he had once supported. So he is a model of moral courage, and we need that. One other thing he did is he reached out to virtually every national security whistleblower that followed him. I'm sure he would have reached out if he were alive to now there are at least maybe a dozen whistleblowers who resigned positions in protest of our support for Israel in its ongoing war on Gaza. So yeah, an extraordinary man, really fascinating to research. UMass has his papers. There are something like 600 boxes of materials.
Well, thank you so much, Chris, for your work. Chris Appie is professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, director of the Ellsberg Initiative for Peace and Democracy, author of three books about the Vietnam War, and a forthcoming biography about Daniel Ellsberg. Thank you, Chris. We'd love to have you back. I'd love to find out more about what your students think about U.S. imperialism.
Great. All right. Thanks, Rose. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And we've done a lot of shows on Daniel Ellsberg over the years. He was called the most dangerous man in America by President Nixon's National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger. He sadly died on June 16th, 2 years ago, of pancreatic cancer. He was 92 years old. Here is Daniel Ellsberg back in 2008 speaking at Google about the book Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers.
Well, I'm glad to say that this is still a free enough country that I don't have to anticipate being arrested for speaking at Google, and yet. That day may come, and when that day comes, I'll wear a suit. And I always tell people that if you have a coat and tie when you're getting arrested, wear it when you get arrested, so that other people see you will understand that having a coat and tie do not excuse you from all the obligations of citizenship entirely. And I've been arrested probably 70 times or so, and I think always with a tie, you know, if I could arrange it. Being back or being at this place gives me a little of the feeling of being back at the Rand Corporation, although, badges. Didn't get signed in by guards exactly. I was a little struck that your data centers are secret locations entirely. It sounds a covert operation there that I wonder whether how well the secrecy can really be maintained. It would be interesting on just how it's done. I worked for the Rand Corporation about 9 years, for the Marine Corps 3 years, for the Defense Department as a consultant, partly overlapping there for any number of years, and as an employee for 2 years in the state, 1 year, and then the State Department for 2 years in Vietnam, then back to the Rand Corporation to work on the Pentagon Papers. And in the course of that time, I took an oath of office a number of times, not at the Rand Corporation, where I made many secrecy agreements, signed secrecy contracts. I understand that I must not tell secrets, like the location of our data center, I suppose, something like that. I don't know if you sign non-disclosure agreements here, do you, at Google?
Yes.
Okay, so you can be fired, lose access, lose promotion, if you maybe even be sued. For all I know, probably you could be sued as a tort, civil court, revealing certainly company secrets of some sort, and perhaps anything that you learned during this. I don't know how far it extends. I doubt if you could be put on trial as a criminal for revealing what you learned at Google, unless it were in the category of a trade secret. Am I wrong? Has anyone had that experience? not in this audience, I mean, of course. Sometime after I had walked out of the Rand Corporation, past the guards, with a briefcase full of top secret documents, and in those days, pre-Pentagon Papers, the guards didn't examine your briefcases. I understand that, to people's great frustration and irritation, that rule changed after the Pentagon Papers came out. I took out 7,000 pages of top secret documents, went to the ad office of a friend of a friend, my friend Tony Russo, who just died last week, and his then lady friend, who had an ad office with a Xerox machine, and Xeroxed these documents, and took the originals back to Rand to my safe in my office, where I had authorized access to this study, the only one at Rand, actually, with authorized access to do research on it. But I shared that with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1969 and 70, all of it. And then when they did nothing on that, they shrank from the political risks of revealing that in hearings or without authorization from the Defense Department. I eventually gave it to the New York Times, and when they were enjoined after 2 days of publication, on their third day they were enjoined for the first time in American history from publishing, I gave it to the Washington Post. And when they were enjoined, to the Boston Globe they were enjoined, and ultimately to 19 newspapers altogether. It was clear by that time I was underground, eluding the FBI with my wife for 13 days, so that we could put these documents out. And it was clear in the appellate courts and finally the Supreme Court that there was no way to keep newspapers from publishing these, because one after another was publishing. They stopped enjoining after four injunctions. As somebody said, it was like trying to capture a herd of bees. And so they couldn't, practically speaking, actually stop it. And in that context, they voted 6-3 that the injunctions themselves were unconstitutional. I think if we hadn't made enough copies to get them to the different newspapers so that they could have stopped the publication with the Times, or perhaps with the Times and the Post alone, that probably, judging from their opinions, it would have gone 5-4 or 6-3 the other way, and we would have had effective censorship at that point, prior restraint, 35 years ago or more. But as it was, they couldn't stop them. I assumed that I was breaking a law. I'd been often led to believe that these secrecy agreements I was signing were based on a law. And they said, I understand, it said that I may be prosecuted under 18 U.S.C. 793 D&E and so forth, which I assumed was an applicable law. What I didn't know, so I assumed I would be prosecuted and that I would go to prison for the rest of my life. 7,000 pages, top secret. I assumed that would be a life sentence. And indeed, I was faced eventually with 15, between the two of us, 15 counts, but me, 12 felony counts with a possible sentence of 115 years. So they did have something like a life sentence in mind. And with good behavior, I'd be getting out in a third of that time this year, interestingly. Now, I didn't get that for a number of reasons, but I wanted to mention one thing here, which will be news to you, I'm pretty sure. I was just a couple of weeks ago speaking to the American Bar Association panel on this subject to an audience much larger than this, actually, entirely of lawyers and judges. And I mentioned that my prosecution with Tony Russo was the first prosecution in the country ever of someone for a leak, for giving classified information to the press, to the public. And I asked, let me ask you, how many knew that, what I just said? Let me see, can I see? Don't be shy, let me put up your hand. I see one hand, really? How many did not know that? Okay, so you're awake. And some are not sure whether you knew it or not. But none of them knew it. I thought there'd be one or two judges. And none of them knew that. In other words, my prosecution was as unprecedented as the famous Supreme Court case on the injunction, which was a civil proceeding. Three other facts, which none of them knew essentially either. There's been one such prosecution since, which led to a conviction of Samuel Loring Morrison in 1984. Supreme Court refused cert in 1987. One conviction. My case was dismissed, the charges. There is one pending now against the AIPAC employees, Rosen and Weissman, which I'll just make a little prediction, will be dropped, I think not. But in any case, it's the third prosecution. There's been one conviction. There is a reason for that. And the reason is, again, unknown to lawyers and judges and journalists and academics on this, almost across the board, is that we don't have an Official Secrets Act. 18793 D&E, under which I was charged, and which people are charged with, was intended for espionage. That's very clear in the legislative history of the case. In fact, the Congress at that time rejected wording from Wilson, from the administration in 1917, that would be an Official Secrets Act that criminalized any release of classified or, and they didn't have classification then, but defended, protected, guarded information from the government without authorization. Most countries have that. Britain, of course, has an Official Secrets Act. We don't because of the First Amendment. We're regarded, the public is sovereign, information is basically the property and owed to the American public and to the Congress, not the property of the government. The government can't copyright, by the way. So although there are copyright laws, of course, civil laws, if you steal someone's book or thesis or something, and there is a criminal copyright law, but very narrow, we don't have a law that criminalizes the release of classified information, per se. There are three small exceptions to that I can come back to later, maybe in the question period, that are relevant to pending cases, recent cases. But in general, just putting out top secret did not violate any law, which was as surprising to me as anyone else. When I assumed that they hadn't been kidding me when they kept telling you, you may be prosecuted. Well, that was right, I was prosecuted. But I was the first. No one else ever had been. And after a year of research, the case was in courts for 2 years. After a year, my lawyer, Leonard Boudin, said to me, we've done all this research, cost a lot of money, looking at unrecorded cases and looking all over the country. It appears you haven't broken any law. I was also charged with theft, conversion. In those days, pre-electronic stuff, pre-the internet, theft was not involved when you copied information. you weren't depriving an owner, if there was an owner, of the use of that property. So that had never been tried before either. Again, I was charged with that. But the leading lawyer on the law of information, Melville Nimmer, had written an appellate brief for the ACLU and later an article in the Stanford Law Review, I think in 74, Melville Nimmer, the undecided issues in the Ellsberg case. And he said, by any previous interpretation of the law, Daniel Ellsberg has not violated any law, neither the Espionage Act, this is not espionage, or theft, or conspiracy. So when I heard that, by the way, that is true. Okay. And somebody asked the question, I think, on your list here, you know, since you obviously violated the law, well, you know, what then, and so forth. I did think I was violating the law. I was deliberately doing that. But I wasn't, by any previous interpretation, in this country with a First Amendment guaranteeing rights of free speech and free press. So I said to my lawyer, well, that's great, you know, I'm home free. I said, well, Dan, it isn't as simple as that. When the government goes into court and says to a jury, United States of America versus Daniel Ellsberg and 12 felony counts, you can't be sure you'll walk out of there free. I said, well, what are my odds? I said, 50-50 of 115 years. I said, 50-50 and I haven't violated any law? He said, well, let's face it, Dan, copying 7,000 pages of top secret material and giving it to the New York Times has a bad ring to it.
That was Daniel Ellsberg in 2008 speaking at Google about his book Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. Daniel Ellsberg passed away on June 16th, 2023, after a battle with pancreatic cancer. He was 92. And you can find all of our past shows about the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War at KALW.org. Click news and then your call. You can also podcast the show, share it with friends and colleagues, and be sure to leave us a review so others can find our show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering today's show, and thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.